This is Embodied, our show tackling sex, relationships, and your health. I'm Anita Rao. Just like people, no two relationships are exactly the same. That goes for what makes partners happy, how they like to communicate, and how they feel about romance and sex. Not every relationship involves sexual attraction. And this is something asexuality activists and community members have been raising awareness about for decades.
We think of gender and sexuality as existing on a spectrum. And instead of being sexual or asexual, asexuality is really a spectrum kind of all its own. You know, everybody has different personal standards of what kind of relationships they'll be in, their own standards for if they ever will engage in sexual activity. And in that way, it's really not that different from everybody else.
On April 6th, the world celebrated the first International Asexuality Day, which highlighted efforts to broaden understandings of sex, romance, and the relationships that fulfill us. Here to talk with me is Angela Chen. Angela is a journalist, editor, and the author of ACE, What Asexuality Reveals About Desire, Society, and the Meaning of Sex. Hey, Angela, welcome to Embodied.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Also with us is Yasmin Benoit. Yasmin is a model and asexuality activist. Hey, Yasmin, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course. Happy to have both of you. So, Angela, I want to start with you. I know that you've spent so much time thinking about language and terminology and the range of vocabulary that we have to express various things. So I'm curious about, in the process of writing your book about asexuality, when you started to look at the range of vocabulary around attraction and hearing about the variety of ace experiences, what did you learn about, how did that shape how you thought about your own identity, I guess, and the diversity of types of attraction that folks experience?
You know, to answer this question, I think I have to go way back to when I first learned the word asexuality. And I was 14 and I read the definition, you know, doesn't experience sexual attraction. And I thought, great, that's interesting. And it had zero impact on how I thought of myself. I did not think I was ace from reading that definition. And it was only years later when I started to really dig deeper that I understood that, as you said, the language around attraction can be so convoluted and that there's such a wide spectrum of experience. I had thought that being ace meant that you were repulsed by sex or didn't care about it, and that's why it didn't seem to apply to me. But the more thinking I did and the more, you know, I talked to others, I realized there was this huge, you know, diversity of experience from people who, you know, are repulsed by sex, but also people who are sex favorable. And many people, like myself, didn't even realize they were asexual because there is this emotional desire for sex, and people can't separate that from the physical attraction, the sexual attraction. So I think I really learned that the way we talk about sexuality and attraction is so tangled up, and that really clouds the way we think about our own identities.
Yeah, you have such a helpful analogy that you use in the book, which is that we're really comfortable with this idea of a one-night stand, the idea that there can be an interaction that is really all about sex and not really about anything else. But we really struggle to think about the opposite of that, the inverse of that, a relationship that is romantic but not sexual. Can you unpack that a bit more for me? Because I feel like that's a really helpful framework.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, by definition, people who are ace don't experience sexual attraction. However, a lot of people still experience romantic feelings towards someone. And if you, you know, if you say that, then most people will say, I understand. But then sometimes they'll say, oh, how is that possible? Isn't wanting to have sex with someone, isn't that, you know, how you know something is romantic? And that's just not the case. You know, the experiences of ACEs show that's not the case, that it's entirely possible to have strong romantic feelings for someone, to be in love with someone without there being that sexual component. But because we often collapse sex and romance, we use those words often interchangeably to separate them, to many people sounds confusing at first.
Yeah. Yasmin, I'm curious to hear your take on that, because I know you talk a lot on your platform about how there's more to love than sex and romance. So I'm curious about what love looks like to you. How do you define it?
Well, being aromantic, which means I don't experience romantic attraction either, I just place all the emphasis on platonic love, or just having friendships and loving your friends and loving your family and just loving all kinds of different things, just not romantic in a romantic way. So that's just like that's the kind of love that I'm drawn towards. That's how my love manifests.
And so when you're in the process of building relationships, I've encountered this so many times throughout my life with really close friendships that I feel like don't really have, there's no, I don't have a word for them in my vocabulary. Best friend feels very childish, but like friend that is, you know, so much more significant and such a deeper connection than any other friend that I have. Like, I don't have the language to kind of delineate the kinds of relationships that I have along the friendship spectrum. So for you, when you are building relationships, do you think about kind of those definitions and how people fall into categories, or do you kind of try to erase all of that and separate yourself from that?
I mean, I definitely don't approach anything with a category in mind. I never really try and categorize my friends or kind of apply terminology to any of my relationships outside of being asexually romantic, which is terms I use out of convenience. I'm not really much of a labeler, so I don't really bother putting that much that kind of emphasis on it, or thinking, you know, this is going to turn into this, or I want it to go this way. You just kind of see how you vibe with someone and where it goes. I mean, I guess if I was specifically looking for what we call a queer platonic relationship, where it is like quote unquote more than a friendship, but it's not really a romantic relationship. And if I was specifically seeking that out in the same way as someone would seek out a different kind of partner, then I probably would place more emphasis on like the, I don't know, the way it's going to map out or who I'm getting involved with. But otherwise, I just see who I vibe with and just go with that.
I want to play a clip from a listener we talked to who shared what it was like to talk about asexuality with family and with friends. So here is Marin.
I feel like talking to people who are older than me, like parents or grandparents or anything like that, like it kind of just comes up as like, oh, by the way, I'm asexual. So like, that's not something that we do in our relationship, which is just how it is for our relationship. Like there are asexual people who still have sex, but like, we don't do that. And I think to a certain extent, like, your parents and grandparents don't really want to hear about your sex life, regardless of if you have one or if you have a lack of one. So it kind of just becomes a statement like, oh, no worries, I won't ever be pregnant. But when I'm talking to my friends, like friends who don't know, sometimes they'll like we'll talk about like people they're attracted to. And it's always kind of like I kind of have to like check myself and be like, oh, the way you're attracted to this person might be like solely sexually attracted, and like I don't understand that. Like when people are like, I don't understand like how you don't want to have sex, or like how you think that isn't like an important part of a relationship or whatever. On the flip side, I don't understand what it's like to want to have sex with someone. So it's always kind of a weird conversation with friends when they're like, ooh, like this guy, like, yeah, I really want to, you know, meh, or whatever. And I'm like, can't relate, man. Like that sounds so unfun to me. I don't even know why you'd want that.
That was Marin, who's our producer, Kaya's sister, sharing her story. Marin lives in Minneapolis. So, Angela, I'm curious if anything that Marin said resonates with you. I mean, you are someone who has done a lot of activism work and has talked in various spheres about asexuality. Does that experience of kind of switching how you talk about your identity within different frames resonate for you?
Definitely. Some parts of that resonate. So for example, the part about not wanting to talk about it with your parents, not just because this is a topic that many people, regardless of orientation, don't want to talk about with their parents. That definitely resonates. I think one difference for me is that I'm not celibate. I'm not sex repulsed. I have a partner who's not asexual. And so some of the social aspects to me are different. And I think the questions that I get mostly from people in my personal life, not when I'm, you know, speaking publicly, are more about education. You know, how can it be that you're ace and, you know, still have sex? So that is a little bit different for me. And I think this is just a different set of questions to answer. But the reluctance to talk about it because it feels like oversharing, that part very much resonates.
Yeah, Yasmin, I wonder what that's like for you. I mean, being so public and having a platform where you talk about your experience, but kind of being able to distinguish that you're not speaking for everyone, you're speaking just for yourself, and you don't always necessarily want to explain every part of your identity in every given conversation. So how do you navigate setting boundaries around that and negotiating that when you do have a pretty big platform?
Well, I don't know if this is a fortunately, but fortunately, up until about for over a year of me being an activist, people that didn't know me for being an activist or people that I hadn't met through my activism could not care less about anything that I did. So people did not know. And therefore, I was very good at like having a don't ask, don't tell policy and just completely dodging the conversation. So I was quite good at avoiding it. Or even when I did mention it, people didn't believe me anyway. So the conversations didn't really weren't particularly constructive. And I was kind of good at avoiding them. But now that people do know about it, the conversations have suddenly become a lot more tolerable. Whereas before, you know, people would kind of spring the like the what is your sexuality question onto me. And it would be in a scenario where I really didn't feel like giving the TED talk about it. And then that would be uncomfortable and no one would believe me and it would be a whole thing. But nowadays, those same people are suddenly a lot more receptive because the media believes me, therefore they do as well. So it's kind of changed the scenario. So yeah, nowadays it's a lot better and I'm able to kind of be my whole self. Whereas before I literally had like a borderline alter ego going on and I'd go and do a conference and go and speak at an event or something. And then I'd get home and we just act like it never happened. Well, not with my family, but with like friends and stuff. We just act like it didn't happen.
All right, we're going to continue the conversation with Angela Chen and Yasmin Benoit after this short break. You're listening to Embodied from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. This is Embodied, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. We don't choose our sexuality. Whether or not we're attracted to someone or no one is just one part of our identity. Those in the asexuality community face a lot of misconceptions and questions about what their sexual identity means about their interest in relationships, romance, and intimacy. And the simplest and most truthful answer is, it depends. Today, we're talking with three people who are raising awareness about asexuality. Still with me are Angela Chen, a journalist, editor, and author of ACE, What Asexuality Reveals About Desire, Society, and the Meaning of Sex, Yasmin Benoit, a model and asexuality activist. And joining us now is Sebastian Yue. Sebastian is a writer, editor, model, and voice actor. Hey, Sebastian, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And we invite you to add your voice to the conversation. We're at EmbodiedWUNC on Twitter and Instagram. So I want to start with a clip from one of our listeners. And Sebastian, I'm curious to get your thoughts after we listen to this clip. This is Camille in Winston-Salem talking about identifying as asexual as a young person.
One thing I think a lot of asexual people deal with is this idea of, oh, well, you just haven't met the right person. Or in my case, oh, you're so young, you don't even really know what's out there. And those are things that I think especially, you know, I see that a lot with my transgender and non-binary friends as well. Their quote unquote choices are being called into question from such a young age, when in reality, it's very brave to make a statement about your identity and know who you are at such a young age.
That was Camille in Winston-Salem. Sebastian, I'm curious about your thoughts on that and your own experience as a young person, learning about your identity and finding the words for it and finding the way to express it and be taken seriously.
Yeah, I think absolutely there is this pervasive idea of, well, how do you know if you haven't had certain experiences? And to that, I would say that, you know, I don't think there is necessarily, you know, where, how old is old enough to know. And even if it turns, you know, I think that if you do come out and make a statement about your identity like that, I think that you really ought to trust somebody else when they say that this is who they are. And even if it turns out that they change their mind later or they have, they've discovered new ways to describe themselves, then I don't think it necessarily means that they were uncertain the first time that they came out and said that. I think that the freedom to learn more about oneself should be a kind of open, that should just be an open possibility for forever. I don't think that there ever is a point at which you stop learning about yourself, but you know, you can still come to identify with a label and just kind of hold on to that. It doesn't really, I don't think there's a limit on that kind of thing.
Are there, I know that you, you're a model and a photographer and have experimented a lot with photography and image throughout the course of your life. And I'm curious about how that process of kind of seeing yourself in new ways has shaped how you understand your asexuality.
I think that especially with regard to my own identity, I identify as genderqueer. So that has been a really cool way for me to try out new ways to express myself. And I think in relationship to asexuality, it's not something that tends to come up a lot while I'm producing that kind of content. But for me personally, I like knowing that that I am participating in it as an asexual person, and that not necessarily everything I do has to be kind of highly scrutinized from that lens, if that makes sense.
That totally makes sense. And I guess it raises some questions about some of the intersections between sexuality and gender. And Angela, I know this is something you've touched on a bit in your book, kind of looking at how asexuality challenges some of our assumptions about gender and about the gender binary. Could you talk a bit about that as it relates to femininity, masculinity, and asexuality?
Absolutely. So I think that we have strong assumptions around the type of sexual desire that people have, and these are based on gender. You know, so for instance, when interviewing the book, a lot of ace men would often say, discovering I was ace, that felt like that threatened my gender, because men are supposed to be sexually aggressive. They're supposed to always want to be chasing women in heteronormative contexts. And so someone told me that when they realized they were ace, they had the thought, oh, am I actually trans? And they realized they weren't, but you know, that idea that men are this specific way, they are very sexual, was so deeply ingrained in them. And so that's one example in which asexuality kind of destabilizes the ways we think about gender. And it's all wrapped up in the assumptions we have about what genders are supposed to be like. And another thing, and for this, people have told me that being ace has sometimes destabilized her sense of gender in other ways. You know, a lot of folks in the ace community are non-binary or trans or gender non-conforming, and I'm not, so I don't want to, you know, speak for them. But many have said that being ace has helped them realize that they were non-binary, for example, and that sometimes it was the first step to figuring out other parts of their identity.
Yeah, and it brings to question kind of all of, well, there's so much that's tied together and rich in all of this. And when you talk about, you know, assumptions about what it means to be masculine and have a certain amount of sex drive or desire for sex, it also kind of connects to the images we associate with various forms of gender. And I know, Yasmin, that's something that you have been playing with on your platform of the campaign, This Is What Asexuality Looks Like, and really pushing back on some of our assumptions about visually what it means to associate different kinds of genders and sexualities with certain images. I'm curious about some of the assumptions that you're pushing back on that people assume about visual representations of asexuality.
Well, I just noticed that growing up, people would always, well, not even just growing up to this day, people would often say, like, you don't look asexual. To which my response would always be, well, what does asexual look like? And even though asexuality hasn't been heavily represented, whenever you do see someone who doesn't experience sexual attraction, or their kind of sexuality is like heavily downplayed, or they just don't have a sexuality, it's usually because they're kind of unappealing. And they're supposed to be kind of like nerdy or kind of, I don't know, like cliche Sheldon Cooper types, really. And consequently, people find it hard to compute that a black woman who is a model would be asexual. And so the purpose of hashtag This Is What Asexual Looks Like was just to say, like, asexual looks like anybody, including me. And there is no one asexual look, and we're a very diverse community. And all the time, I know that it perplexes people to see, you know, me modeling and still, you know, identifying as asexual, but it doesn't really make a difference. Like, there's no asexual dress code. Whether I'm wearing like a like lacy lingerie or a trench coat, it doesn't make a difference.
I love that. I want to play a clip from Marin that talks a bit about the assumptions we make about how what people look like and what they're wearing, what that says about their sexuality. Let's listen.
I think like the root of that asexual stereotype that like asexual people don't want to look sexy and don't want to, you know, dress up and look cute is the fact that people think that when you dress up to look nice, you're doing it for someone else. Whereas like for myself, like I'll dress up because I want to look cute. And it's exclusively for me. Like I'll send a selfie or like whatever to my fiance and I'll be like, I look great. And they'll be like, that's true. You do. But it's not like there's no ulterior motive. I'm not like, I want to get laid tonight, so I'm going to wear this dress or whatever. I'm just like, I want to wear that dress because my legs look great. I think sort of like breaking down the stigma of like dressing up for other people versus dressing up for yourself plays into it a lot. I don't dress up for other people. Like I don't care if other people think I look sexy. Like if I think I look sexy, that's the end game.
That is Marin from Minneapolis, our producer Kaya's sister. So Sebastian, I'd love to talk with you a bit more about attraction and thinking about this. Obviously, you work in the fashion industry that is, you know, thinking about image and clothing. But how do you think about your definitions of attraction and who and why you're dressing in particular ways? Is that for you? Is that for others? And how that intersects with your identity?
Most of the time, I think that absolutely is for me. But at the same time, I do, I am aware that that other people, if I'm outside or whatever, other people are going to perceive, you know, I'm going to be perceived. And I think a lot of that, you know, even if subconsciously, I'm thinking like, how will they perceive me? Because on a surface level, I actually don't really mind. But it does bother me sometimes when I am not perceived as the gender that I actually am. So a lot of people, if I go outside, are going to perceive me as a woman, which, okay, that's okay. But it does bother me to think about. And so there was a period of in my life when I was trying to actively influence that. And then I realized that actually there isn't very much I can do to change how people are going to see me. So I've become more focused on doing what makes me happy. And if people are going to make misperceptions, then that's not really something that I am responsible for or can control.
Completely. And defining or feeling like you need to change your image based on how others perceive you is kind of this endless, could be this endless cycle where you're not able to really create and be artistic on your own terms, which I know is something that's also important to you. You're a writer and you're a creator, and you think about image in a whole variety of spheres.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that once you start trying to do what is going to please or make sense to other people, that is not a way in which you're going to get the maximum happiness for yourself. And so once you come to realize that it's okay for you to put what makes you feel good at the top of your priorities, then I think that's a really good way to go about it.
As the asexuality activism space evolves and grows, Angela, I'm curious to hear about some of the conflict and tension that has come up for you in your work about kind of distinguishing the nuance of asexuality from sex negativity. We're a show broadcast out of North Carolina. We're in the South. We've talked a lot in our show about sex education and purity culture and sex negative culture. And I guess I'm assuming that that's something that comes up. One of the things that you all are asked to kind of speak back against, which is how do you distinguish asexuality from sex negativity?
I think a lot of people assume that the two are the same, and they're definitely not. And I always want to acknowledge that, of course, purity culture and sex negativity exists. But I think even within those cultures, there's actually an obsession with sex. For one part of the book, I interviewed someone who grew up evangelical, steeped in, you know, purity culture. And growing up, he told me, we were told we weren't supposed to have sex, but somehow everyone was kind of thinking about it and talking about it. And that kind of culture actually kept him from realizing that he was ace, because that kind of culture actually assumes that everyone is sexual. So asexuality is not about being sex negative. It is about dismantling the assumption that everyone is sexual. And it is about people being able to not experience sexual attraction and refuse sex if they want. And if people do want sex and they do want, you know, and they do experience sexual attraction, that's fine too. But because there is this long history of shaming and the control of sexuality, I think people are very sensitive. And anything that looks like purity culture is put in the same bucket when the message is actually very different. The message is you can be sexual or not sexual in any way you want. Not everyone should be less sexual.
Yasmin, is that something that you've come up against in the fashion industry? I mean, you spoke a little bit about our assumptions about kind of lingerie and sensuality. I'd love to hear a bit more about how you think about the aesthetic that you're building and being able to be sex positive in the way that you define sex positive.
Yeah, well, I've always tried to kind of blend sex positivity in with my work. I mean, it's kind of part of the package when you work as a lingerie model. It kind of, I know, it means that when people are learning about asexuality through you, they're entering it with the idea that, okay, she's probably not like this anti-sex person when she's working in like a sexualized part of the industry and obviously having a great time there. I mean, when I'm working with like, not just with lingerie brands, but like, you know, kind of like brands that do sex toys or they're focused on sexual happiness. And I've written articles on sex and pornography from an asexual perspective for like pornographic sites. And, you know, I've kind of like, I've done events and talks on that. So I think it's important. I also think it's a great way to kind of break down that misconception outside of the community that asexuality does fall hand in hand of being sex negative or anti-sex, because I think that is a particularly damaging stereotype which leads to asexuality being left out of sex positive conversations. And I've also noticed that it bleeds into the reason why some people feel uncomfortable with asexual people being present at pride events, because they associate it with being sex negative and they think that we are against what everyone else is doing there, because prides tend to be pretty sex positive spaces. So I definitely try and like use my platform and the assumptions that people probably make as soon as they see me to my advantage and hopefully to the community's advantage as well.
How has your activism been received by other Black queer folks? I mean, you mentioned some tension between folks who are asexual and the queer community not always being fully embraced in queer spaces. What has that been like for you?
If we're talking about just the kind of reception within the LGBTQ plus community in general, I feel like personally in real life, it's been great. A lot of my work is pride related. I'm doing stuff for Lesbian Visibility Week. And I'm not even a lesbian. So I feel like they definitely embrace me. But then it's weird because I'll then talk about the work that I'm doing offline and I'll mention it online. And then you'll get the whole, you're asexual, you shouldn't even be doing that. And it's like, I was literally invited to do that. But in terms of the intersection of Blackness as well, I honestly feel like, I mean, I'm speaking from the perspective of someone who's Black in the UK. I feel like a lot of the Black community just is not even having a conversation about asexuality. 99% of the stuff that I do is white media or like white queer groups or white people interviewing me. It's very, very, very rare. I can literally count on half of one hand how many times I've done an interview with a Black person before my entire time doing this, and it's been years. So I generally cannot tell what they actually really think about the conversation about asexuality or what I'm doing. But I can say that the white queer scene in person has been pretty receptive to me anyway.
Sebastian, I know that you have created a variety of workshops and panels kind of looking at the intersection between race and asexuality, which I guess I'm assuming means you've connected with at least a few other folks who are on those panels with you and in those conversations. How have you experienced the ability to talk about the intersection of race and sexuality in your experience?
I've found that currently the conversation, like whenever I've done one of these panels, I've always got people coming up afterwards saying, well, thank you so much. I'm really glad that that this happened. I've personally had feelings about this subject, but didn't really know how to articulate them, much less that other people also experienced them. So I've found that these conversations don't really happen unless we kind of make them happen. It's been like coming from a Canadian context, I've found a lot of people who have who are very forthcoming about their experiences, and so it's been really nice to chat to other people from a variety of different backgrounds. So I'm lucky in that I've met people who are really open to having these conversations and are really open to sharing their stories and themselves. So it's been a really good opportunity.
I only have about 30 seconds left in this conversation, but just very quickly, I mean, I'm curious about the international aspect of this. Sebastian, you're talking to us from Canada. Yasmin from the UK. I know this year was the first International Asexuality Day. Sebastian, do you feel like there is a international community of asexuality that is strong, or is your community more country-centric?
I would say absolutely there is. The very first time that I participated in any kind of asexuality awareness was the World Pride Asexuality Conference in 2014. And I met people there who I still speak to today. So I would say that there absolutely is. And I think that as technology is evolving, I think that it's only going to become stronger. So I'm happy to say that there is.
I've been talking with writer, editor, and model Sebastian Yue, journalist and author Angela Chen, and Yasmin Benoit, a model and asexuality activist. They will all stay with us after this short break, and we'll talk more about media representation and relationship building. Stay with us on Embodied.
Gaming kind of connects my generation, the younger generation. You know, everyone in my generation plays games. I think of all the people I know, one person doesn't play video games.
In a new episode of the Embodied podcast, gamers take us inside the elegant and engaging worlds of video games designed to help strengthen our connections with others. They also introduce us to communities built by gamers that connect them to people they may never have met IRL.
It's kind of that universal connector, and everyone has strong opinions on it, and it's just a good bonding tool to find friends and to just escape from whatever may be troubling you and just get lost in a video game. I use they, them pronouns. It's not common in real life. You just don't come across non-binary people that often. And so a lot of times I get misgendered in public, and Spectrum is a space where that doesn't happen because everyone is accepting and everyone is welcome and open to the idea of non-binary people existing. And yeah, we have trolls who try to come in and harm us, but we've a pretty good security system of keeping them out. So it's just a place where you can really focus on whatever it is you want to do or want to be or be perceived as, and not have to please everyone around you and fit into a mold that society has created.
Hear the full episode Played, What Today's Generation of Gamers Get Right, by subscribing to the Embodied podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Now back to today's conversation on the Embodied radio show. The first International Asexuality Day was celebrated April 6th. It underscores the ongoing push for greater representation of those across the asexuality spectrum.
In the fantasy genre, it's interesting how people can imagine like elves and dwarves and dragons and all this, but they can't imagine a human being who doesn't want a romantic relationship. That's just very strange to me.
That's fantasy author Lauren Jankowski. I'm here with three people to talk about representation, ace communities, and activism. Angela Chen is a journalist, editor, and the author of ACE, What Asexuality Reveals About Desire, Society, and the Meaning of Sex. Yasmin Benoit is a model and asexuality activist. And Sebastian Yue is a writer, editor, model, and voice actor. Angela, I want to start with you and pick up on something that you talked about a little bit earlier in the conversation about being in a partnership with someone who is not asexual. And you've had conversations with people about what to do in a relationship if partners desire different amounts of sex. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about that and about boundaries and what you've learned about kind of navigating boundaries and consent conversations through your own relationship, as well as your research into how other folks navigate their relationships.
Right. The first thing I always say is that these questions are not only relevant to people who are ace. Mm. Desire discrepancies are so common, no matter what your orientation is. And so when it comes to, you know, solutions, I think a lot of them are similar to what you might find with a straight couple that's in therapy. You know, so much about deconstructing, you know, the role that sexuality and sex plays in your relationship. Are you communicating okay? What does everyone want? Does everyone feel safe? But when it comes specifically to ace and non-ace couples, I think there are a few other things to consider. And one thing I've heard over and over is that the allo couple, the not ace member, will often feel rejected. You know, they'll take it very personally, because I think in society we often think someone's desire for me is in some way a reflection of how attractive I am. There's this idea, if I were more successful, if I were more physically attractive, then you would want to have more sex with me. And so I've interviewed people who said it was a light bulb moment when my partner realized that wasn't the case, when I was able to say, it's not about you. It's not about whether you do it for me or anything like that. This is who I am, and it's not a reflection of your worth. And I think that's really interesting, because I think many of us have internalized the idea that, you know, other people's desire is about us. And another thing that's really important is to not pathologize the lower desire partner. So often there's this idea that the higher desire partner is the normal one and the lower desire partner is the broken one, and they're the one that needs to fix themselves, and they're the ones that needs to try meditation and sex toys and all of that work to bring themselves up. But if you think about it, the real problem is not high desire or low desire. It's just incompatibility. So really, it's the responsibility of both people to find a solution that works for them. And it's not helpful to think about it as one person is, you know, just living their life and the other person's the one bringing everyone down. And I think that's a perspective that's often really overlooked in these discussions about negotiation and relationships.
Completely. And we don't have a lot of models for having those conversations. There isn't a lot of good representation of great consent and great conversations about desire and different levels of desire generally, let alone within context of folks who may have different kinds of definitions of what they want and different kinds of identities. And I'm curious, Yasmin, I mean, if you have thoughts about, you talked a little bit about, you know, your experience in the media talking with folks about your identity. Where do you feel like we are in terms of representation right now? Like, how much representation is there of asexual characters and those kinds of ways that seeing yourself represented can be really meaningful?
I feel like we are in a very similar place to where we were like 10 years ago, or possibly more than that. I feel like we've been kind of at a consistent standstill. And I know people can probably pluck examples from, like, I don't know, independently published books, or like there might be a character in like a video game or in a podcast or something. But in terms of like well-known, like mainstream representation, in the same way you could like name about 20 something gay characters off the top of your head, we are severely lacking in that, or even in like a kind of nonfiction space, which is why I try and use the media presence I have to contribute to that. And whenever we do get that kind of representation, it's usually kind of similar. It's usually just kind of like a, I don't know, girl next door, or just kind of guy next door, usually just kind of white and unoffensive. So I feel like it's almost like whenever I talk to people that have been doing activism for a lot longer than me, I like compare our experiences, and it's kind of like a Groundhog Day. Like the questions I get and the questions people got like almost like 20 years ago, it's like the exact same thing. The conversation has not really moved forward that much, especially when you compare it to like other parts of the LGBTQ plus community. So yeah, I feel like things haven't really changed a huge amount, but I think that the internet is definitely helping, as it's always helped the ace community. And yeah, and I mean, people tell me all the time that like just the representation that I provide, or just seeing someone in who's kind of in the media or just kind of on a public platform being kind of openly asexual and, you know, achieving stuff and just being confident is very helpful. And I think it just helps asexual people know that you can live like a happy, fulfilling life and just kill it, even if you are asexual. It's not a hindrance.
Sebastian, how about in the realm of literature? I know that you've written your own fantasy adventures and think a lot about literature and fiction. Do you see ace characters in fantasy fiction? Is that a space where there is representation?
I would say that, well, in the spheres that I'm familiar with, just because I know mostly other queer people, so The authors that I would work with, they go out of their way to ensure that they themselves are represented and that the other people that they know are represented. But I think that in general, mainstream, I think that that definitely could be better. And I think there also is an interesting conversation to be had about using the term asexual in fiction, especially if you're using a setting that is different to a contemporary setting. Because if you say asexual, that means that your society has the same kind of identity structure and labeling system that ours does. And I do think that if you don't do that, there is the possibility of creating a universe where we don't divide people based on gender and sexuality in the same kind of way. Although I understand why people would want to use that, because it's very powerful to have a creator explicitly put in their work, like, yes, this person, this character is asexual. And it really does help people feel seen.
I love that. And it kind of plays off of what Lauren was saying, is that, you know, we could expand, we could use fantasy to expand our definitions of what worlds could look like. But it also is a catch-22, because getting that real-life representation is also important. I want to play another quick clip from Lauren, who is a fantasy author and has been thinking about these conversations.
I'm seeing a lot of people trying to fit asexuality into a heteronormative lens, which bothers me. As a fiction writer, I've been quite open about how when I started, I was working with this teacher who... he's kind of the reason why I was in the closet for so long. He said I couldn't be a writer if I was asexual, and none of my characters should be asexual because it's a construction of patriarchy and all that BS. And the first draft of my books was atrocious. It was not my voice at all. It was his. But when I got away from that, thank God I found Snowy Wings. When I signed with Snowy Wings, basically I was told, tell your own story how you want to tell it. And that's what I've done. And I know a lot of people have really responded positively to that. It's been very cathartic to explore aspects of my own identity, being Arrow Ace, being an adoptee. Writing a story that I always wanted to read when I was younger.
That's fantasy author Lauren Jankowski. Angela Chen, I'd love to come to you and keep playing on this idea of fantasy and fantasy spaces, but talking more about sexual fantasy. I know you've thought about how sexual fantasy and fetish can be played with not being in the framework of just purely sexual attraction. Could you talk a bit more about that?
Absolutely. So in the course of my reporting, I spoke to people who identified as ace, and they told me about ways in which they experienced sex and sexual themes that wasn't about attraction. And one thing people would say is, you know, I do have sexual fantasies, but they're not the kind that most people talk about, which is that you're the person having the fantasy, you know, it is your perspective. And it's not about being attracted to people, but it's about, for example, being attracted to concepts or ideas, or maybe a sense that there's a sexual fantasy, but you're disembodied and it's not this first person perspective. And I think all of that is so fascinating because it really raises these questions, you know, when we're talking about sexuality, when we're talking about fantasy, what is it? What is the role that attraction plays? And if it's possible to have sexual fantasies without sexual attraction exactly being involved, and, you know, from my reporting, it is possible, how does that challenge how we think about, you know, even how we define fantasy, how we define sexuality? So I think these are all really, you know, I don't have answers, but I think these are all really fascinating questions that ACE experience brings up.
I'd love, we only have about 5 minutes left in the show, and I'd love to close out spinning off of, Yasmin, what you were saying about how you feel like in some ways the conversation has stunted a little bit, and we're having the same conversation today that we were having 10 years ago. I'm curious about y'all's thoughts on what's keeping that conversation from expanding and what the keys are to expanding that conversation. I know that talking explicitly about sex as a key to liberation has been a big part of a lot of queer movements, and I wonder whether it's that framework itself that keeps us limited or whether it's something else. Yasmin, let me start with you about any thoughts on that.
I think it's a combination of things. I think primarily it's that people outside of the community aren't ready to listen and haven't been ready to listen. And if they are ready to listen, they're only prepared to in very small doses and not enough to cause the culture shift that would be required to make lasting change or really kind of bring asexuality to the same point as other orientations are at. And I also think that, I think within the asexual community, there's a combination of shyness. Like a lot of people aren't quite confident enough in their sexuality for understandable reasons to be that loud about it. And then I also think there's almost like a kind of like learned helplessness where it's like, no one's going to listen anyway. So why bother kind of making a lot of noise or trying to do that? And then the end result is that we get the occasional burst of attention and then people forget again. And then we do it all over again in a few months' time. And then we just keep doing that for decades. So personally, I think that's kind of what the issues are.
Sebastian, how about you?
I would say that at least within queer spaces, I'd say that a big part of it is a lack of solidarity. I think that just because every so often there is this one conversation that comes around like every 6 months or so, and it's whether or not asexual people should be allowed to use the word queer. And I think that that is not a productive conversation to have necessarily. And I'm always thinking like, well, I'm talking with other queer people. I think that we should focus on, you know, why it's important to listen to each other. I think that it's important for me to listen to conversations about what's happening within spaces that I'm not necessarily a part of. And I think that if we focus more on ways in which we could help each other as opposed to who is allowed to do what, especially when the result isn't materially harmful, I think that we would be able to get further. And so I would really like to see more solidarity among the community at large.
Angela, any closing thoughts? I mean, obviously writing your book was a helpful bridge builder, I know, in many ways to get conversations started. But now kind of looking at where you are and looking at where this conversation is and how to make it go in a new direction, what do you think needs to be done to get there?
I think one problem is that it's very easy to think you understand what asexuality is and not understand it at all. Mm. So in the context of writing the book, a lot of people who are progressive folks, people who are queer, have written to me or commented and said, I thought I knew everything there was to know, and this made me realize I actually didn't even know what asexuality was. So I think there's this problem of language and this problem of the depth of explanation. Another problem is that there is just structural invisibility. So for instance, recently I saw a Gallup poll, and it was talking about the percentage of Americans who identify as queer, LGBT, and the poll methodology has no place in which to mark that you are ace, even though many ace people were not heterosexual, but we might not also, you know, where do we fit? So I actually wrote in to Gallup to ask about this, and they said something like, oh, you can just, if you're ace, you can just write in your answer. But how can you know you're ace if you never see that around you, right? Many people do not know they're ace, and they don't know they're ace because they only see LGBT in these surveys. And so on the structural level, they're, you know, we're not being included. We are being included more and more, I think, in queer spaces. You know, queer organizations, I think, are doing a lot of outreach. But when it comes to the mainstream, I think there's a real aversion to building us and including us systematically instead of just giving us these bursts of attention.
I have to end the conversation there. Thanks so much to Sebastian Yue, Angela Chen, and Yasmin Benoit. And thank you all to listening to Embodied from North Carolina Public Radio. I'm Anita Rao.